It's arguable that we would not know about Patricia Lockwood were it not for the internet. She was described as the poet laureate of Twitter. Her poem, Rape Joke, went viral in 2013. Online was where Patricia Lockwood discovered her voice. A tweet she sent to the Paris Review, "So is Paris any good or not?" became famous. Now, after a brilliant and best-selling memoir, Priest Daddy, Lockwood has written a novel featuring an extremely online narrator who became famous after a tweet which said, "Can a dog be twins?" And as a consequence, travels the world speaking about online culture. And then her sister discovers that her unborn baby has a rare genetic disorder, Proteus syndrome, and what's called the portal, the internet's tone of overworked irony, fails to work anymore. And as the protagonist of the book says, if all she was funny, and none of this was funny, where did that leave her? The book's called No One Is Talking About This, which, if you are not a Twitter aficionado, is a meme-y thing. And Patricia Lockwood joins me now. Hello, nice to talk to you.
It's so wonderful to talk to you again.
I said novel. Did you hear my inverted commas around novel?
I heard actually a lot of invisible air quotes.
No.
Withering, a couple.
No, not withering. Please do not be withered, at least not yet, because we've got 45 minutes to go.
But I'll save it.
Can we call it an auto novel?
I think that we can call it an auto novel. Yes, I think that that's fair. The strange thing is that all of the interviews I did at the beginning, I kept expecting to hear the word autofiction and no one ever used it. Finally, I just brought it up myself. I was like, yeah, we can call it that. We can call it autofiction. Why is no one using this term with me?
Why is no one talking about that?
Exactly. It's come in really handy. The title has a lot of applications across a lot of different areas.
Do you think that people didn't want to go into the auto area because the second part of the book is so painful and so beautiful and so personal that people waited for you to bring it up? I'm not going to wait. I'm going to talk to you about your sister who had this wonderful and, in many ways, damaged child who only lived 6 months. That's the second half of the book.
That is the second half of the book. And I knew that you would not wait. That is what I appreciate about you. But yeah, again, when I was talking about it at the very beginning, I think people felt that they could not ask. And they didn't want to ask what was true in the first half because the answer to that might imply what was true in the second. So I told them, I said, you know, a lot of the first half is fictionalized. It's fictionalized, you know, through humor a lot of the time. But the second half is largely drawn from life. And the personality of the child in the novel is drawn from my niece, Lena.
Who had Proteus syndrome, which is what?
So Proteus syndrome is a disorder of the overgrowth pathway. So a lot of times it will present asymmetrically. One side of the body will experience the overgrowth. She had it in her brain and she had it in her right side. She had it in her fingers, which grew out from each other, these middle fingers like a moss antennae. It was actually quite lovely. And we only saw the beginning of it because she didn't live for a very long time. But yeah, it was in her eyes. There were cysts in her brain, which the doctor said just continued to grow as long as she was alive. It is what we believe the elephant man, so-called, Joseph Merrick, was believed to suffer from. So yeah, it's an interesting illness. She was the only person, or she was the first person who had ever been diagnosed in utero. So she represented this, you know, this opportunity for excitement, I think, for a couple of the more callous doctors. And of course, she wasn't that for any of us. For us, she was unique for other reasons. She was an opportunity for excitement for other reasons.
But some doctors treated her as an excellent opportunity for research.
There was one particular doctor, yes. And I didn't write about him very much in the book because he was so much overshadowed by the other doctors, the neurologist, physical therapists, the nurses who worked with her. But yeah, there was one doctor and he was the hotshot guy and he had seen all the cases. And he was excited. You know, he said, I have never seen anything like this and I will never see anything like this until the day I die.
Your sister Mary, who gave birth to Lena, is strangely a research pharmacist at the University of Cincinnati who studies rare diseases.
Yes. So actually, she worked on the Moderna vaccine. She worked as a pharmacist at Kroger, an American grocery chain, throughout her pregnancy and afterwards. And then she said, you know, I can't do this anymore. I want to do something really meaningful. And she did get a job as a research pharmacist. And she worked on the Moderna trial. She delivered, you know, some of those first vaccine doses to people in those trials. And that was extraordinarily meaningful for her. And I was very happy that she had that opportunity.
She obviously gave you her blessing to write this book. And I'm wondering
yes.
if, because I read, Patricia, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is another sister before Mary also gave birth to a child with a genetic abnormality. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. My older sister, Christina, had a son with a chromosomal deletion.
And so is there a way in which this story in No One Is Talking About This embraces both of those?
It is, but I don't think anyone would see it except me. There's almost like this slit in the text that I can point to, and it's right as the eclipse is happening. It's toward the beginning of the first part, and it's a humorous paragraph in the novel. You know, these two women are sitting on a park bench and talking about whether the eclipse can make you blind if you're not looking at it, basically. And in reality, I was sitting outside during the eclipse, and my older sister was texting me to tell me that she thought he was going to pass away soon. That's what was actually happening at that moment. So I experienced that every time I ran my eyes down the text. No one else would know. Only I knew, but that was there. And I think that that did lead me in a way to the second part. When that was happening to her, I was about to fly to Australia. I was about to come see you wonderful people in the Antipodes. And I was not able to be there for her in the same way. I think that the reason I felt such a strong compunction to be with my younger sister when this unthinkably happened again is because of that oversight, because of that callousness in myself.
Anyone with even a passing acquaintance with the internet will cry out in recognition in the first part of the book when you describe the portal as somebody put it, I'm not sure whether it was you, infested with the privilege of those who have nothing to do all day but monitor one another's speech on social media and locate the blind spots of news reporters.
But that's, not me, but yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah.
It's pretty good, right? I mean,
yeah.
And I'm not sure whether you regard this as a conversion story or as a corrective. What do you want to achieve with it?
Well, I don't think about achieving something with a novel. It's not really what I set out to do. I didn't set out to write a corrective. I think some people have read it that way, but mostly not. I think that most people get to the end of it and see the same thing that the protagonist does, which is that this was a place that we came to create language together and to put pictures and fragments of our lives so that other people could see them. I think it's profound, and it's something that I felt, that when she comes to the end of the book, what she's thinking is that she wanted so much to put her niece's picture in the portal so that people could just encounter her as a part of the broad stream of things. And so I don't think, you know, that it's a conversion. I think that what she finds in the second part is that the portal has given her a language to use to think about this child, to describe this child, and perhaps even to feel a contrast with. Some of our delights are felt by contrast. So if she felt that parched desert, that poverty of experience before, then she maybe even more feels the immense flowering of the second half. So no, yeah, I'm not a person who really sets out to write anything. I'm just like screwing around. I'm saying like, see what happens here. And then you get to the end. And I think that you do see that there's something to it, something to all this wasted time.
You may have been screwing around, but let me quote. Every day we were seeing new evidence that it was the portal that had allowed the dictator to rise to power. This was humiliating, like discovering that the Vietnam War was secretly caused by ham radios, or that Napoleon was operating exclusively on the advice of a parrot named Brian. which is sort of classic you, right? Because you've got the poignant truth, and then you've got the crack up afterwards. The dictator, of course, we all know who you're talking about. Yeah. Has your father, the hero of Priest Daddy, ever wavered in his support of Donald Trump?
No, I think he doubled down. And incredibly and horrifically, I was giving my first round of interviews for this book right after the January 6th insurrection. And I was just going off left and right. I was absolutely popping off on the subject of my father and Donald Trump. It quieted down after a moment, but it was so incomprehensible to me. I think it was incomprehensible to a lot of us in there. We saw it happening. We saw him rising to power. We saw him being legitimized somehow. We saw him being crowned. We saw him take up the megaphone of that place and speak. And the entire world, the narrative of the world, have to bend to his voice. We saw all of that happen. And we were trying to reconcile that with our version of reality. It was very, very hard to do. And for those of us who had, you know, that irreconcilable reality in our own families, I think it was even more difficult.
This is not people going online to look at photos of their nephew and 5 years later believing that the earth is flat, which is one of your lines. This is the internet talking about the Capitol storming, for example, and the whole alt-right and QAnon business. Mm-hmm. This is the internet, which was once a place of play for you, becoming mad, bad and dangerous, surely. Did you feel that?
I did feel it, but I also felt it in those moments to be crucial. It's the same thing that happens after a mass shooting. It's the same thing that happens, you know, after like a cop kills an unarmed black child. The portal then becomes indispensable. And I think it actually reminds us of why we're there. It is raised, I said, I think to the New Yorker, to the level of a jewel or an eye. And you see all these facets pouring in at once. You see this documentation. We saw Charlottesville that way. And strangely, at those moments, that's the time that you feel least like leaving it of all. Because if you leave, you will not be plugged into that any longer. You won't be seeing the world through those insect eyes that are taking in everything. And what happens to you then?
So that sounds very sinister. Don't you find that sinister?
Oh, it's horribly sinister. Right. Now, let me ask you a question. How online do you feel yourself to be? How resonant was any
hardly,
of this with you?
No, I mean, completely resonant because yeah. I cast an eye over Twitter, but I do not participate in it. Mm-hmm. So I'm a passive observer.
Yeah, a lurker.
I'm talking to Patricia Lockwood about her book, No One Is Talking About This. Still pressing on your father for a moment. Mm-hmm. When your sister was pregnant with Lena and it was clear that Lena was suffering from Proteus syndrome, she came up against the law in Ohio which banned induction, and Lena's head was growing too large. But the law in Ohio banned induction before 37 weeks, no matter how big the baby's head was, as you say. And your father, who'd spent his life crusading against abortion, said, surely there must be exceptions. That seems astonishing that he was presumably, when he was completely anti-abortion, not thinking about what the reality was of that. Do you think?
It's true of a lot of men. And I will tell you that the only way to deal with that was to get hammered absolutely every night, because I could not deal with it. I could not understand how it took something like this for him to be able to see. And that's what she says in the novel. So he's fictionalized as a cop in this. That's how I get away with it. But yeah, that was largely my father's reaction. There was something very interesting about Lena's case and my sister Mary's case, where, so one of the great bugaboos of my childhood was the so-called partial birth abortion. That's what the pro-lifers that I was raised by, that I grew up amongst, called it. And that's basically where they do induced labor. The child is partly born and the head is suctioned to allow for a safer passage through the birth canal. And that's done to save the mother's life, to save her fertility. And this was literally one of the cases where that would have been appropriate, that procedure. And, you know, there was this total ban on those because they had used it as this very visceral, field on which to sentimentalize this issue. You know, like, These people are such barbarians that they would do something like this for fun. And that was actually indicated in Mary's case. And after this very difficult delivery and birth, you know, she had two subsequent pregnancies and she had difficulties with both. And I think it is because of that. So if you have to have that in your life, if that has to happen to your daughter before you can understand, and then you still only understand in her case, you only make an exception for her, then I don't know what to tell you. I don't even know what to say to you at that point.
What do you say to your father now?
Mostly nothing. Mostly nothing. I haven't spoken to him for a long time. There was tenderness in my heart toward him, though, because it's also true what happens in the novel that, you know, my father is the one who brings the entire Catholic Mass packed up in a miniature suitcase that is labeled Rome Essentials. He is the person who's setting up the Mass at the foot of my sister's bed and saying it for her child. You know, he is the one who is carrying the body of her child down to the morgue himself. And he was the one who was laying her to rest with his own rosary. So it's difficult after that. You still have these ideological conflicts, but you've also seen that side of a person. He's given that to you. He's done that for you. And it's hard to remain estranged beyond that when you have seen that grief. And that grief, I do believe, is real.
Have you read... See, I'm going backwards and forwards from the second part of the book and to the first part of the book, because they're not clearly defined. Mm-hmm. And one... The first part leaks into the second part. The second does not leak into the first, which is why it comes as such a visceral shock. Have you read John Ronson's book, which is part of a number of books, one of a number of books saying similar things, So You've Been Publicly Shamed?
I have not actually, but it was also a Riverhead book, so this is apparently one of their concerns.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting. And what he says is highlighted by a part in No One Is Talking About This, where you say, and this is a description of the Twitter sphere, every day their attention must turn, like the shine on a school of fish, all at once, towards a new person to hate. Sometimes the subject was a war criminal, but other times it was someone who made a heinous substitution in guacamole. And that's true, in that there seems no shading, no context, no tonal shift between guacamole and war crimes anymore. And that I know from just observing the Twitter sphere. Do you think that this is just a phase?
In humanity, like, is this something like the internet will pass and we'll all move on
to
other greener
fields? I don't think the internet will pass, but what we do with it, do you think that this is going to be looked back upon as the kind of growing pains, or is this what we're stuck with because we are all deeply stupid?
Well, I do think it changes with each new platform. So there is a little bit of hope there. The weird thing about Twitter is that it really outlasted its lifespan, its natural lifespan. We were all moving on from it. Donald Trump takes up residence there, and we all are stuck there as in a sort of purgatory or limbo for like 5 more years. That should not have happened. But it is a good question. It's the crucial question. I was interested more, as the protagonist is, in the animal element of it, where it's like the waters have been chummed, right? And we all whip around at the same time. And you do feel that sleek shine along everyone's sides at the same moment as you turn toward what seems like food. It seems like what we are doing is feeding. Like there is some necessary component in it. Like it's what we're meant to do. But I've also been around long enough that I remember Blogspot, I remember Diaryland, LiveJournal, Facebook, Tumblr, all these places. And the conversation is a little bit different in all those areas. I do think that Twitter should probably be salted and burned to the ground, and whatever is next should be given to us. But I do have hope because I think that we do adapt our language to each new place. I'm just hopeful that there's a new place soon.
Yeah, okay. I think you're the person to set it up.
Right? Yeah. Oh, I don't have the technology. That's what I should have done instead. I should have been a coder.
Ah, well, there is yet time.
There's time.
I spoke to the New York Times technology writer Kevin Roose a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he at one point, and I think that a lot of people have had that experience, at one point he had a hard time telling where the internet stopped and his personality began. And a similar feeling is expressed by you when you made a speech to the British Museum in 2019, and you say it had once been the place where you sounded like yourself. Gradually, it had become the place where we sounded like each other. Back to the hive mind, the attention, turning to the new person to hate. Do you know who you sound like if you just do not touch the internet for a month? Or have you never, ever experienced that in recent times?
No, I have actually. That's been one of the things the last few years have given me. It was so difficult for me to be online during Donald Trump's presidency. It felt too hectic. I don't form opinions or have conversations in the same way as other people do. My digestion is not quite as quick. So I was able to take more time off Twitter in those years than I otherwise would have. And then when all of this happened with my family, you can't. You're in the hospital, you're with your family. And you don't have time to be scrolling Twitter constantly. I have always had a very solid sense of my own voice. I don't know that Twitter actually is the place where I found my voice. I think that to a certain extent, I've always sounded this way. When I go back to my earliest internet writing, my earliest blogs, it still sounds the same, which is an interesting phenomenon. But there is something that happens, I agree with that technology writer, where when I'm lying down at night, I have the oddest physical sensation that a window opens up to the left of my temple, and the conversation of the portal is still going on in there. And it's that I want to get away from. It's the noise. It's not so much, I think, the effect on my voice, which I think has remained intact. It's that sense that I'm always slightly tuned to a conversation that is happening just a little bit to the left of my own brain.
So you may not have found your voice on the internet, but a lot of people first found your voice on the internet.
Absolutely.
And so you're clear that what they're hearing is your voice and not a whole bunch of internety voices that have merged into one big thing.
I think so. I think that I have been able to remain a little bit dispassionate about like meme language, about the sort of thing that you do encounter in the portal, and turn it to my own ends. A couple reviews did sort of make it seem as if the book were written in internet language, which I don't think it is. I think it's written sort of in the same language that I write prose poetry in, or some of my previous fragmentary works. I think that is still the same from piece to piece, but it is examining what we're doing in the internet. It's examining that language, but I don't necessarily think it's written in that idiom.
Where are you living now? Are you in Savannah?
Yes, I'm in Savannah, Georgia. We just moved to a new little house with a tiny little saltwater pool.
Wow. And is Savannah, Georgia lovely?
It is so beautiful, and the flowers are all in bloom.
And is it dripping with Spanish moss?
It is dripping with Spanish moss, and it's full of yellow fever ghosts. Everything you've ever heard about it is true. Have you ever been?
No, never.
Okay, you must come. It is absolutely beautiful. As soon as tourism starts up again and everybody's got their vaccines, you should come here.
What are yellow fever ghosts?
So there was a massive epidemic, and the first thing they tell you when you move into your picturesque little apartment downtown is that basically the streets are paved over those bodies, just thousands and thousands and thousands of epidemic ghosts wandering around and sort of milling around under your feet.
Oh, have you ever felt that?
No, I'm not much of a ghost person, but whenever someone visits me, I will go on a ghost tour with them and help them look for orbs and stuff. I've never seen any myself, but like my friends are very into orbs. So I'm like, I'll go with you. I'll look for the orbs. I'll do the orb duty and I will try my best.
So do they see the orbs and do they go, look, look, and you go,
they
can't
do.
See it?
Yeah. Yes, I acknowledge the orb if it's there, but most of the time it's just like something in someone's camera phone. So I don't say that part, but I'm like, yeah, that is quite an orb. That's a beauty. That's a real one.
Good Lord. And what do they think the orbs signify?
Oh, just spirits, I think. Just, you know, little floating spirits out there in space.
Okay. Now, speaking of epidemics, to the pandemic, and was it last March you got COVID?
Yes. So I am past my anniversary and I'm also fully vaccinated at this point. So as of about 2 weeks ago, I had the Pfizer vaccine and I'm good to go.
And did the vac, because you had long haul symptoms, right?
Yeah, I still do.
What were they?
So I had what I understand now to be psychosis in the period immediately after COVID. I developed delusions. Yeah, it was very frightening. I developed delusions about the floorboards in my apartment. I believed that they were going to fall through. So I developed this really like Baroque system of like tiptoeing and hopping and pouncing around my apartment. So I didn't have to like, you know, light on any of the planks that made squeaks or anything like that. So I would like crawl around. I would jump around because I believed basically that my apartment was about to collapse. I believe that my husband did not have COVID, even though he was just as sick as I was. I believe that he was faking it to get attention. I believed all sorts of things that later turned out not to be true. And then a couple months later, I developed pretty severe tachycardia. Both of my arms went numb and I developed really severe neuropathy, muscle weakness. I couldn't turn my head for like 2 months. It was very, very frightening. And at that time, you couldn't even see a doctor in person. So I'm on a Zoom call with a shaved head because that's what I had done, you know, in my post-COVID craziness, trying to explain these symptoms to doctors that you couldn't even see.
Have you found other people who have had similar long-haul symptoms?
Yeah, and I had a couple in my town. So my friend Joni, who runs the wonderful bookstore, The Book Lady, was sick about the same time, and she had to use a walker afterwards. The strange thing about being in the really first wave, like the late February, early March people, is that you didn't understand that there were other people experiencing any of this. And because you were neurologically affected, you didn't even know that some of this stuff wasn't normal. So it was only a couple months afterwards when I was writing that piece for the London Review of Books that some of this became crystallized. I was like, okay, so I have all these symptoms. And it was just around that time that other people were starting to talk about having them too.
And what do you think? I mean, have you thought about why a virus might inflict these hugely varied symptoms on you?
That is the question. It was so strange. It was like it was traveling around to different systems at once. Yeah. You know, for 2 months, you would have migraines. For 2 months, you would have intense gallbladder pain, and then those things would go away. But I don't know. I don't know if it's just your immune system freaking out. I don't know if there is some sort of viral persistence. I don't know if we just got a really big dose of the virus because it was before anyone was really wearing masks. I have no idea. I do think that down that path probably lies insanity if you try to figure out exactly what is happening to you. But the interesting thing about the vaccine is that you do experience for a week or two like a return of the long-haul symptoms, and then it gets better. So I'm just about 2 weeks post the second one, and I'm still experiencing some of the resurgence of the effects, but I'm hopeful that soon I will have some relief from that.
Yes, that's another strange thing. Why would the vaccine ameliorate the long-haul symptoms?
I think it might just give your immune system that little goose. And you know, not the nice thing, but my husband has had some of these things too. So it's not like I'm the only one who's experiencing them. So I do feel like I have some solidarity. I don't feel like it's all in my head or anything like that. These are really concrete symptoms that you can point to and be like, oh, look at this crazy thing that's going on.
Yeah, you might have been so crazy that your husband's just agreeing with everything you say.
He's agreeing with everything. And I'm like, you know what? I'm the one with the perfect brain. Why did this happen to me? My husband's head is this like beautifully empty meadow. He didn't need it. You know, he just does some accounting at work. He does not need it in the way that I do. Why me?
And despite all this, and despite the psychosis and the pouncing on the floorboards and the complete lack of empathy, you are still married to this man.
I am more married than ever, Kim. Yes.
We should point out that you met online. I mean, your life online is remarkably robust and productive. It's not like you sit around. It's you write beautiful things. You met your beautiful husband. It's not a place that you're saying, you know, abandon all ye hope, all ye who enter here or whatever it is.
It's really true that if you found a husband in that place, you can't hate it too much. You know, if you did find your agent because of your like Twitter sex, you can't hate it that much. So yeah, telling everyone at this point, like, hey guys, like let's jump ship would be a little bit hypocritical, I think. Yeah, my history with the internet, goes back such a long way and is so storied. And so many good things have happened to me because of it. And it also represented for me freedom and education and the place where I could be exposed to other non-Greg Lockwood views.
Yes. I mean, imagine if the internet had never existed. There you would be.
Ooh.
Holding that sign up.
Exactly.
There is a TV adaptation, I understand, underway or in the wings of Priest Daddy, correct?
This is correct. Yes. So I'm co-writing it with Heidi Schreck, who was just on Broadway with her one woman show, basically, What the Constitution Means to Me. And I think that we just finished writing the second script. So yes, it is in process. It hasn't been picked up yet, but we've got two scripts written and I think that they will decide about it soon.
And are you happy script writing? This is a whole new thing for you.
I love it. I am a little duck in water. Now, understand that I have no sense of what happens either in a story or in human lives. So a lot of times my co-writer will say something like, we just need to do some emotional tracking here to make sure this makes emotional sense. And I'm like, oh, what? Like, what do humans do? How do people behave? I don't know any of that stuff. I am here to write good freaking jokes, and I can do that, and I can write them on command. In that sense, I'm very useful in the sense of, like, again, what do people do with their lives? A little bit less useful.
You speak of yourself as if you were a Martian. Is that how you feel?
I've always felt a little bit like a Martian. I am one of the people who did not get the manual. And I think in the first half of No One Is Talking About That, this is like what you see. It's true in Priest Daddy probably as well. It's like I'm standing in a corner watching these goings on and being like, why are we talking to each other like this? Why are we saying these things? Why is this the topic of discussion of the day? Why do we all hate this guy now? What exactly is going on? So it can be useful to be a Martian if you're a writer. Maybe all writers are Martians to some degree.
Yes, you might be right. And some of them do write specifically like that in that mindset. Just tell me about that tweet that became so famous that you sent to the Paris Review. So is Paris any good or not? For the people, you're talking perhaps to somebody out there who has no idea what the Twitter sphere is. What's the evolution of that tweet?
I think it just popped into my mind one day. Sometimes I can remember the genesis of particular tweets, but this one, I think it was just like, oh, haha, that's funny. Paris Review, LOL, is it any good or not? I think that was about the level of intellect, intellectual architecture behind that tweet. And you just pop it in there and sometimes it goes crazy. And I do describe that feeling a little bit in the first half where she's like, you know, sometimes something that you put in the portal would just become this fire that seemed to race over the globe. And it felt like you had to be there watching what happened with it.
So unless you continue to participate in that, what could possibly replace that instant applause, that sense of feeling most alive, which is where your narrator feels most alive on the portal?
I think I feel most alive in the actual composition of the tweet. I have always found it kind of uncomfortable to go viral. Certainly to have something like Rape Joke go viral in the portal is an uncomfortable physical feeling. You feel all of these conversations going on in the ether where you're the subject. That's not, I don't think for normal people, that's a comfortable feeling. So I always took the pleasure, I think, in writing a joke that I liked and that my friends would like. And the ones that were really far ranging, the ones that eventually end up, you know, in the hands of K-pop stans, those are the ones where it feels a little bit like something has gotten away from you.
One of the passages that made me cry out in recognition was this one. There was a new toy. Everyone was making fun of it. But then it was said to be designed for autistic people. And then no one made fun of it anymore, but made fun of the people who were making fun of it previously. And then someone else discovered a stone version from a million years ago in some museum. And this seemed to prove something. And then the origin of the toy was revealed to have something to do with Israel and Palestine. And so everyone made a pact never to speak of it again. And all of this happened in the space of like 4 days. And that's exactly what happens. This kind of pivoting to try to find the correct position from people who've never dreamt of having a moral compass previously in their entire lives. It's weird and it's phony.
It's animal movement, right? You're looking around to the rest of the herd to see what they're doing. And it is the movement I'm interested in and the speed of something like that. So there's, first of all, the question of, again, like, why is this the thing that we're fixed on today? Why is this the topic? And then there are always these twists and turns. So in a sense, these things actually do become interesting just by virtue of going through these trajectories. Rarely do they start out as interesting topics, but they sometimes end up as interesting ones.
So, it's not a conversion story. Is it a story, as somebody said, is it a love letter to social media? Because it's extraordinary what's happening on it. Bad or good, it's extraordinary. Or is it a revelation of the horror of it?
I don't know that I think in those terms. I think it was just, again, me standing in a corner witnessing some frenetic activity that I didn't entirely understand, but that I had at the time pretty good jokes about. That's a lot of times how things start for me when yes. I have observations that I don't really know where they should go. And then those accrue. I think my books do build by accretion, like very slow accretion. And at the end of them, I have something. And in the case of this one, I didn't expect the turn that it was going to take. You know, I thought, do I have to write about Twitter forever? Is this whole book going to be like this first half? I didn't know what was coming.
You really didn't know that you were going to segue into the story of Lena, or you didn't know how you were going to?
It hadn't happened yet. So it happened in the middle of the writing. So the turn or the shock of the reel that the protagonist feels is my own shock.
Oh my goodness. The text. I did not realize that. Extraordinary.
Yes. Yeah, so the process of composition, it happened all in real time. And the lecture that I gave at the British Museum, where I'm wearing that, you know, red dress with the butterflies on it, that was just, I think, 2 weeks after her funeral. I had worn that dress to the funeral. The last thing that I had read in public was her, you know, was a speech for her, speaking about her. So all of these things were happening. All of these things are embedded in the text in a way that only I really know about them.
What a strange life you lead.
Maybe, yeah.
No, really. I mean, it's the father and the sisters and the fact that your sister was working on the Moderna vaccine and then you got COVID-19 and everything's so strange. You
it all feels a little narrative at times, right? Like a little bit planned, like that someone's getting even with me or someone's enacting some revenge on me at times.
But you feel like you're on the mend now. You're no longer bouncing up and down on the floorboards.
Right. Actually, that's why I moved to my new house. As soon as I got out of that house and I didn't have to think about those floors anymore, I was released. I was like an eagle in the sky. So that was a big thing for me. But yes, I am feeling a lot better. And the thing for me that was difficult is that, as I wrote in the LRB piece, I had a really, really difficult time reading and making sense of text for a while. And as long as I can read, I'm okay. I'm like, you know, I might have the arthritis, I might have the tachycardia, the neuropathy, but if I can read, I will be fine.
And you still have the arthritis.
Yeah, it's
but you can write.
Bizarre. I can. So I do a lot with dictation. I use voice to text. And I never thought that I had a Midwestern accent before, but I must, because it every third word is misspelled. And it must be actually the thickest Midwestern accent in the world. So I have all of these like accommodations that I've come up with in order to, keep writing at the level that I want to be writing at. Because that never stopped. I kept writing the whole time.
And ordinarily, you would, of course, be on a book tour with No One Is Talking About This. Are you happy or sad not to be doing that as a consequence of the COVID?
If I could teleport to all those places that I missed so much at the beginning of quarantine that were so real to me through my travels, New Zealand, Australia, Europe, Canada, all of these places, if I could teleport to them, I would have loved to have done it in person. That, you know, if COVID had been plucked out of the universe and made not to exist. But there was something, I guess, fitting about doing all of these interviews through Zoom, sort of not being able to touch people. A lot of times my interviewers would cry. A lot of times I would cry. It did feel like in some way we were processing the last year together. It felt like we were in something together. A lot of people said that this book was one of the first books that they were actually able to read after lockdown and after quarantine, which was very meaningful to me.
Excellent to talk to you. Thank you so much. And
wonderful.
I hope your recovery continues.
Thank you so much.
Patricia Lockwood, whose book is called No One Is Talking About This.